This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 308 was recorded on January 27th, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks, the billion-dollar alternative investment platform that lets you invest in art by legends like Warhol and Picasso for a fraction of the cost. Precious metals guru Ronnie Sterfeli returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll start with the big picture of what's going on with the Federal Reserve and this week's equity market volatility, and then we'll move on to a precious metals chart deck I know you're going to love. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick's chart deck is titled, Is the Market Bottom In?
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Eric, let's just jump straight into the stock market. When we were recording last Thursday, everything was still a little bit of calm because we recorded before the market closed. And just in 1 week, amazing how rapidly this turned into a volatile downdraft, the way it pulled down. I mean, we basically have traded all the way down to the September lows, a solid over 10% market correction on the downside. And even on the FOMC, the market rally seemed to be very short-lived on the reaction. What's your take on all of this?
Well, Patrick, I think it's absolutely essential to understand what message the market is sending us with this big volatility event and how we should interpret it. Now, that doesn't mean I know the answer to that question, but I can propose a couple of multiple choice possibilities, which I think will hopefully be instructive. But we really need to ask ourselves, you know, regardless of whether the bottom is in and it's really time to buy the dip, or maybe this is just a dead cat bounce and a full-on market crash still lies ahead of us, we don't know the answer to that question. I don't think anybody knows the answer to that question. But if we interpret what's going on here from a textbook macro standpoint, the way to interpret it would be to say, okay, what's happening is the market is telling us that the Fed has signaled a policy error. And by being too hawkish, too aggressively, they're going to crash the economy into a recession. And the S&P 500 is a leading indicator of recessions. That's a question on the Series 65. And we know that the government and FINRA never get anything wrong when it comes to economics. So it has to be right. That's basically the explanation. And what it would mean is this is telling us that a recession is coming because the Fed has screwed up and is about to crash the economy. I personally don't believe one word of that stuff. I think we live in a new normal reality where the market doesn't work on economic fundamentals anymore. It's based on liquidity. And I think what's really going on here is the reason that the market is selling off is because the market participants know that the Fed has little choice but to start withdrawing stimulus as the pandemic is ending. Now, if I'm right about that, what that actually signals is that growth is coming in the economy, not recession as the pandemic recovers, but that economic growth, that good news, is going to be bad news for the stock market because it also is going to mean that the Fed really will stay the course and withdraw stimulus and so forth. And of course, then you have to start thinking ahead and say, well, wait a minute, what if that is true? And it is all about the Fed really intending to stay the course and they do crash the stock market. Well, how far does that go before the Fed does an about face and changes their mind? And if this turns into a buy the dip right now and the bottom really is all the way in, is the market simply telling us that it's looking ahead, knowing that the Fed is eventually going to make that U-turn? Or is it really the case that I've got it wrong and economics works the way the Series 65 test says it works? I don't know, but I think those are the questions to focus on.
All right. Well, we can look at some charts on the markets in the post game, but what I want to do is move on to the dollar index because really in the post FOMC period, what was a relatively quiet and low volatility currency market suddenly has come to life and the dollar index breaking to a fresh 52-week high while it's definitely being driven by a breakdown in the euro. Do you think that this has room for more follow through on the upside? What do you make of the dollar here?
Well, I think it's time to wait and watch very carefully. The break above 97 on the dollar index was clearly a reaction to the hawkish Fed stance at the FOMC meeting just yesterday. So is that a knee-jerk reaction that's going to retrace as soon as everybody calms down, or is it just the beginning of an epic move that takes us back to 104 on the Dixie? I have no idea, but it's time to watch carefully, I think, here. And I think what it really depends on is the market going to discount all of this messaging from the Fed to say, okay, they really are going to stand pat and they really are going to do all the things that they're saying. They really are going to hike rates four times this year or whatever the latest count is. It's all really happening. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that the market looks through that and says, no, that stuff's only going to last until the market forces their hand and it's temporary. So I think it's going to be very interesting to watch. I have no predictions. I'm going to be watching to interpret from the dollar as well as from the 10-year yield and everything else how the market eventually digests how serious the Fed is about their current messaging.
All right. Well, let's get to another market that's been just interesting the way it's trading is crude oil. I mean, we went through last week a little bit of a pullback. I mean, we're off maybe $3-4 off the highs. It finally looked like crude oil was calming down a little bit. But note the last couple trading sessions blasted off to a fresh high. What's your take on the price action? Is $90 next?
I think it will be, Patrick. Let's start with EIA inventory. Crude oil surprise build this week, 2.4 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 1.8 million barrels. Gasoline building 1.3 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 2.8, with U.S. production ticking down 100,000 barrels to 11.6 million barrels. So with that less bullish than expected inventory build, you'd think the market might have taken a pause, but it sure didn't. It only took a few minutes before it was back into high gear to the upside, and you just couldn't hold back that bull. Now, what's been driving all of this upside price action, the explosive upside price action in WTI, I'm convinced is actually the fear of Cushing, Oklahoma running out of oil. And it's not really running out of oil. It's getting down to its minimum operating capacity, which is actually something like 30%. So it's not out of oil, but it's at the point where it starts to create difficulties in delivering that contract. And I was also corrected by our good friend Pat Hemsworth this week, who explained to me on Twitter, you know, these days, it used to be all about Cushing inventory, but these days, so much of the WTI contract is actually settled with exchange for physical settlement mechanisms that really, it's not just about Cushing inventory. It's about wherever there is deliverable WTI inventory that is eligible for EFP to settle that contract. One way or another, regardless of whether it's Cushing or someplace else, the market is getting worried about the shortage of oil that's expected in coming months. The best way to understand that is by looking at the time spread charts. We'll save that for the postgame segment when we can actually take a look at the chart deck.
All right, well, let's move on to gold because, you know, for weeks, if not even a month or more, gold was nicely progressing north of 1800, working its way higher highs, and really just looks like the FOMC just completely took the wind out of the sails of gold as we have a reversal right back to 1800 and even are temporarily trading below there. Are we just going to go back to trade range markets here in gold, or is this just a fake out? What's your take on all of this?
Well, Patrick, my intended commentary for this week was going to be, hey, look, so long as we stay above 1830, this chart looks really bullish. Well, needless to say, that didn't happen. As far as how do we interpret this? Okay, we broke below the 100-day moving averages. We're speaking right now. We're actually about $5 below the 100-day moving average. Now, on the face of it, that's pretty darned ominous, and it looks like, boy, maybe we have just broken down below an upsloping price channel. The channel support was up there around 1812 or so. Maybe we've just taken out that support, taken out all the moving averages, and this is the beginning of the end. Well, okay, the gold market has been wrong-footing us left and right in both directions for months now. This was a knee-jerk reaction to the Fed, clearly. Is it going to be sustained, or is it just a buy-the-dip opportunity? We're definitely down to buying the dip if you think it's going to dip. This is the spot. We said that about the stock market last week, and look what happened. I don't think gold is about to dump, but if you look at the chart, it is a possibility. We'll see what happens.
Eric, let's wrap up with just touching on the 10-year Treasury yield.
Well, Patrick, I've got to be honest with our listeners here and say, look, I can tell you that this is not the time to take your eye off the ball and not pay attention to it. But as far as what's about to happen next, I have no idea. I'm not sure anybody does. What is going on here is the market needs to essentially digest the FOMC meeting, the Fed minutes and so forth, and decide. I think the critical question, as I said earlier in the market wrap, is what's going on here? Is this about the market telling us that it thinks there's a recession coming because of a Fed policy error? Or is this a temper tantrum that the market is throwing until the Fed reverses its policy? We'll see what happens. And is the market going to look past that and anticipate that the Fed will eventually reverse policy? Or is it necessary to have an outright crash before that reversal occurs? I think those are the things that we're going to find out here, watching the 10-year yield and finding out, you know, the big fear was if the Fed is as hawkish as they say they're going to be, they run the risk of crashing the bond market. Is that really going to happen? Or are we just going to see a very small edging up in yields? Well, it's time to get your popcorn out and pull up a chair and watch carefully.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is Incrementum founder, fund manager, and precious metals guru, Ronnie Stufferle. Eric, why did we get Ronnie back on the show this week?
Well, Ronnie is a really smart macro thinker. He's a precious metals expert, and I particularly wanted to get him on when I saw a meme that he has in his chart book that really speaks to what I think the key question is in precious metals, which is, hey, the expectations of the gold bugs, the whole gold bug narrative about someday the government's going to print too much money and it's going to debase the currency and the gold's going to go to the moon. All of it happened except for one thing, which was the gold going to the moon part. All the other predictions came true. What gives here? I really wanted to get an expert on, and when I saw that some of Ronnie's recent work is focusing on that topic, I wanted to get him back on the show. So I think you're really going to love this interview.
Well, Eric's interview with Ronnie is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you listen to just one podcast per week, stick with Macro Voices. But if you can listen to two, tune into Smarter Markets by Abaxx Technologies. Join us for the remainder of January as we kick off the new year with our series, What Are Smarter Markets?, hosted by Grant Williams and featuring Jeff Curry, head of commodities research for Goldman Sachs. Future episodes will feature Abaxx founder and CEO Josh Crum, as well as yours truly, Eric Townsend. Smarter Markets brings you the entrepreneurs, icons, and executives of commodities, capital markets, and technology to rant on the inadequacies of our systems and riff on ideas for how to improve them. Our weekly episodes explore how technology can be leveraged to redesign and improve markets to meet society's biggest challenges, including energy transition. Join the conversation on Twitter at @smarter_markets.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Ronnie Stufferle, managing partner and fund manager for Incrementum. Ronnie prepared a terrific slide deck for us. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. Now, if you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you haven't registered yet at macrovoices.com. Just go to the homepage, macrovoices.com, look for the red button that says looking for the downloads. Ronnie, it's great to have you back on the show. I'm looking forward to diving into this precious metals-focused slide deck. But boy, what a week in the markets. Why don't we start with the big picture? What happened? What's going on? Why the sudden return of volatility? And how do you see this market environment?
Hi, Eric. First of all, I don't know if it's too late, but anyway, Happy New Year to all and to you and all your listeners. Well, it seems that volatility is finally back. I mean, we all knew that the market was pretty expensive, and you know, we went into the new year with the largest forward PE discount for emerging markets relative to developed markets ever. We were trading at a 40 times CAPE multiple, which is, I think Dave Rosenberg wrote it, that's a 3 standard deviation event that we last had in November 2000. And we all know that the next year, so 2001, the market was down 18% to everyone's surprise. And it's, you know, it's not only the PE ratio, it's also you know, the S&P's price to sales ratio is at 3 times. It's the price to tangible book ratio at 15 times. So the market was very, very expensive. And I think that the market participants realized after this tremendous year of 2021, where the S&P, I think, made 70 new all-time highs with very, very low volatility. It was the lowest realized volatility since 2017. It realized, first of all, that, you know, Jay Powell seems to get really, really serious, and the 3 to 4 rate hikes plus tapering plus quantitative tightening is not really something that the market really looks forward to. So this turbo taper, this tapering on steroids, I mean it's something that obviously caused this major and brutal correction. But from my point of view, I'm seeing it fairly relaxed. And first of all, one of the reasons is that there was a great chart that I retweeted yesterday. It's by the guys at 314 Research. It shows that if the sell-off should continue, the Fed will probably stop hiking before it started. So history says that in 71% of all Fed hikes, they have come when the market is within 6% of its 12-month high. So I think the market now is already kind of discounting that the 3 to 4 rate hikes won't really happen. From my point of view, it will be a one and done. And I think, you know, coming back to the equity markets, I think market participants seem to forget that household ownership of equities is now at 45 trillion. That's an all-time high. That's actually twice the size of the US economy and way above the historical norm, which I think is at 13 or 14%. So that means that a 20% drawdown in this cycle, and you know, 20% corrections are just something normal usually. A 20% drawdown in this cycle will feel more like a 60% plunge. So therefore, I think that it's almost impossible for the Federal Reserve to do 3 or 4 rate hikes this year. I think they will have to do the U-turn pretty soon, and this will be the point in time when they completely lose the last rest of their reputation. So I think it's a highly interesting development that we're seeing at the moment, and I think that gold is perfectly reacting to this whole development. It's already kind of sniffing out that the Federal Reserve will have to reverse its course.
Ronnie, I want to ask you the question that I've been pondering all week, which is, if you were to consider what an academic or somebody on the cable channels would say about this situation, they would say, look, the reason that the stock market sold off so hard is because the stock market is a very well-known predictor of economic recessions. And so, therefore, what the market is telling us is that the Fed has signaled a policy error, is trying to be a little bit too hawkish too quickly, and it's going to cause a recession which will affect corporate earnings, and that's the reason for the market sell-off. I say baloney. The market doesn't work that way anymore. That's the old normal, pre-2009, back when fundamentals mattered. These days, I think the market is mostly a casino that's driven by available liquidity, most of that supplied by central banks. And I think that what this is about is the market kind of behaving like the mafia, saying, oh, you don't want to buy any protection services from us? Why don't we talk to you in a week, see how you feel about it then? This, in my eyes, Ronnie, is nothing more than the market roughing up the Fed in advance of the FOMC meeting. And I should mention that we're speaking on Tuesday this week, a couple of days before this airs. But I think this is the market roughing up the Fed, threatening them, saying, you better be careful what you do at your next meeting. And I don't think that if the Fed called their bluff and said, well, we're going to hike anyway, the stock market might crash, but I don't think it means economic recession. I think it means finally the gig is up for the liquidity-driven stock market, and I don't think that's going to happen either. I think the Fed is going to reverse course, exactly as you said. But do you think that if the Fed stood pat that it really is an economic recession that's coming, or is it just the breakdown of this new normal liquidity system that's breaking?
Well, I think actually, as I mentioned before, the addiction to high and rising equity prices is higher than ever, and therefore I think that even a small correction will massively impact consumer sentiment, and therefore I think you know, the yield curve is already kind of telling us that that the economy is not doing so well. We all know that we've got a midterm election year, and midterm election years are always complicated. Just remember 2010, remember 2014, 2018. They were all years of, let's say, monetary detoxification. So we saw end of QE1 in March 2010. We saw, I think, end of QE3 in October 2014. And then 2018, we all remember that year, quantitative tightening and, you know, Jay Powell saying a long way from normal. So I think those years are always pretty tough. But, you know, I wonder why so many people are now being caught on the wrong foot. Because, you know, the current correction, I mean, we already saw it underneath the surface. If you had a look at, you know, the market breadth, for example, we already saw that only a handful of sectors were making new highs, and none of them were cyclical. We saw that the Russell 2000 was massively underperforming, and I think what was most important for me, and this is why we took a very profitable short position in the Nasdaq, we saw that the market behavior over the last couple of weeks was kind of changing. I think people were starting to sell the rallies instead of buying the dips, and that was for me the sign that, well, you know, a bigger correction could happen now. But I think I'm not too bearish for the time being. I think that corporate credit, at least until now, does see the current events as some sort of a non-event. So I don't see panic in the corporate credit market. So my take would be the Federal Reserve will move slightly more dovish. So I don't think that we will see three or four rate hikes this year. I think we will see one, maximum two. I think the market will like that. But I think what's really important going forward, I think we have to become much, much more selective when it comes to equities. I think the easy part of this bull market is probably over. I think it's time to take some chips off the table, to reduce beta, to de-risk, to move into other sectors. I'm seeing great value in the energy space, in the commodities space in general, of course, in the gold mining space. So I think it's not necessary anymore to be in those, you know, big FANG stocks that were responsible for most of the market move over the last 12 months. I think this time actually is over.
Ronnie, you're probably best known as a precious metals expert, so I want to move now to your slide deck. And I got to tell you, when I saw page two of the deck, I think this meme you have here is probably the best piece of content I've ever seen on a Macro Voices slide deck, because it is just so true and so simple. So for anybody who doesn't actually have the deck in front of you, I'll describe it. There's looks like about a six-year-old little girl talking to a man dressed in a suit who looks like a Wall Street guy. And the little girl says, "Hey, mister, I predicted 7% CPI in 2021. And Wall Street guy says, "Wow, little girl, how much money did you make?" And she says, "I bought gold." And then the final picture is you see him consoling her. Looks like somebody died. Ronnie, I've been listening to this gold bug narrative for 20 years now that basically goes, look, we're going to get to a point where the government's going to just run out of options. They're going to print too much money to base the currency and gold goes to the moon. And I always said, okay, these guys are maybe a little bit alarmist, but I know they're going to be proven right eventually someday in the end game. Well, guess what? They're being proven right in all those predictions except for one, which is the part about the price of gold going up. What the... over?
Okay. Well, Yeah, I mean, I think this meme really says more than 1,000 words, and we wrote a piece for Raoul Paul's Global Macro Investor, where we basically explained from our point of view what actually went wrong, and you know, our time is precious, so we shouldn't beat around the bush. 2021 was extremely disappointing for gold, especially as we saw this major move in inflation, as we saw real rates going to extremely negative territory. It was disappointing. But, you know, so the question is, what happened actually? And as you can see on the fourth page, well, actually, you know, if we take a step back, we saw gold doing very, very well in 2019 and in 2020. Gold was up 18.3% in 2019. It was up 25% in 2020. Now, last year, gold in dollar terms was down 3.6%. In euro terms, which counts for us over here, thanks to Madame Lagarde, gold was up 3.6%. So it wasn't actually that bad. So you know, I would say if we have a look at the performance table, I think that gold already discounted this major surge in inflation in 2020. And I think, you know, we really should manage expectations. Nobody should expect Bitcoin-like performances from gold. Obviously, it has a slightly different volatility, as we saw over the last couple of days. Gold's role is to protect your purchasing power, to protect your savings. And actually, I think it did a pretty good job over the last couple of years. And we should not forget, Eric, that gold in August 2018, when it's made its lows, gold was up compared to the August 2020 top. It was up 80%. So it really had to kind of digest this massive move. And then, of course, there are other reasons, as you can see on page 5. Actually, as I've said before, equities were up. The S&P, for example, 29% without any major volatility. So for every fund manager, there was actually no necessity to hold any protection, to hold any gold as a portfolio stabilizer. So I think those were the main reasons. Of course, then we also saw a strong US dollar. We saw that Bitcoin was stealing the show. And I think most importantly, perhaps from the flow side, we saw that institutional players, and I regard ETF flows as a gauge for institutional flows, you know, they couldn't care less about gold. And what's interesting, Eric, is last week on Wednesday, we saw 3 tons of inflow into GLD. And on Friday, which was a very, very turbulent day, we saw 28 tons of inflows into the gold ETF, the GLD, which was the biggest net inflow in US dollar terms in history. So I think it's really changing now. I think that gold has kind of reappeared on the menus. It has reappeared on the watch list, and therefore I think it's a pretty interesting setup at the moment.
Now, you really piqued my curiosity with one of your comments. Let's go back to page 4 for a second. What you're saying is, okay, it's not that gold didn't react to this inflation and debasement and so forth. Look at 2019, up 18.3% in U.S. dollar nominal terms. In 2020, up 25%. So, of course, as the pandemic news comes out, gold's really, you know, up 25%. That's a darn good year. But it seems to me, Ronnie, that if what you're saying is gold's doing an excellent job of anticipating these things, well, okay, if it's not up anymore now, it sounds like the gold market is persuaded that maybe the Fed really is going to unwind all this stuff and that we're not going to continue indefinitely with all of this money printing and what I consider to be central bank largesse. Is that the way to interpret this? Because frankly, my base case was they keep on partying.
Yeah, well, they probably keep on partying, and we all know from the times when we were young that such parties can can last much longer than we all think, especially if there's illegal substances involved. So I think actually, and that's contrary to what many people in the gold camp think, I think the end game or the big reset or whatever you want to call it, it can take much longer than we all would expect. And but still, I think that gold is, I think it's more of a transition hedge or a singularity hedge. And from my point of view, at some point, gold will be repriced. And I think one such of a repricing will be more than enough for every investor actually in a lifetime. Now, coming back to your question, Eric, I think that if we have a look at page 6, for example, I think that gold was sniffing out that real yields take a dive. And I think that it anticipated future inflation very, very quickly. And my take is, I think gold cannot be compared to most other asset classes, to high-yield bonds, to convertibles, to tech stocks, whatever. And I think the main reason is that gold is something special. Actually, in every country, on every continent, in every culture, in every religion. So I think the wisdom of the crowds is much bigger than in other asset classes. So I think that gold, therefore, is sniffing out that those major moves much earlier. And I think gold at the moment is kind of starting to sniff out this big policy mistake that we're seeing coming from the Federal Reserve. Because, I mean, we all know, and I'm on record with that this will be the shortest and the shallowest rate hike cycle in the history of the Federal Reserve. And I think if we have a look, for example, at slide 16 or slide 17, it shows that actually, it shows how gold is behaving before and after the first rate hike in a new cycle. And actually, it was really interesting in 2015. Gold actually made its low. And I remember this day pretty well because everybody was forecasting gold to go below 1,000 bucks. But it actually made its lows exactly on 17th of December 2015, on the day of the first rate hike. And if we have a look at page 18, for example, the first rate hike when Maestro Alan Greenspan was still around in 1999, and we all know that this campaign wasn't so successful either. Only a couple of days later, actually 20 days later, after the first rate hike, gold made its lows. So I think we are at this stage where the market or the gold market is already pricing in, well, this rate hike cycle won't last very long. And therefore, I think, that's one of my calls for this year. I think we will make new all-time highs this year as the market will realize that this rate hike cycle will be over before it really started.
Ronnie, let's talk about this coming rate hike cycle, because I'm going to go on a limb here and say maybe this time is at least a little bit different, in the sense that I think you and I probably share a little bit of cynicism that, hey, you know, they say that they're not in the business of bailing out the markets, but you know, when markets really start to tank, that they're going to have to, and they're going to get much more dovish because they're going to rescue the market. I mean, that's just the bias that I have based on history. What seems to me really is different this time is, in the past, when they supposedly were on a hiking or tapering campaign and they kind of abandoned it and reversed course and turned much more dovish, they weren't fighting inflation then. Now they're looking inflation in the face. So when they turn dovish, they have the risk of exacerbating that inflation. Is that going to make them maybe stay the course a little bit longer or a little bit harder than the market is expecting?
Obviously, inflation is a topic again. So that's a great question. You know, we put out a special report on inflation in December 2020 when the CPI in December, I think, was at 1.2%. Now in December 2021, it came out at roughly 7%. So for the first time since June 1982, I think that was the time when the movie E.T. premiered in US theaters, we got CPIs above 7%. So it's really something big. However, we know that mainstream economists keep telling us that it's only transitory, even though Jay Powell kind of admitted that perhaps it's a bit more sticky than he previously suggested. My take would be, Eric, that due to the base effect, we will see inflation numbers coming in slightly lower over the next couple of months. And this will give, I think, central banks, this will give them leeway to stay much more dovish than the market is expecting. Now, we should not forget the one-year inflation swap is trading around, I think, 3.7%. So the market is forecasting that over the next 12 months, basically, CPI will be almost half of the current 7% reading. The two-year swap is trading at 3.3%. So the market believes that inflation will be even less of a problem in 2 years. So I think, and that's really the big question, at what point will long-term inflation expectations really pick up significantly? I think that's the really, really big question out there. And from my point of view, we're seeing some sort of a beginning of a wage price spiral. As you remember, Eric, there was this strike at John Deere, and that's just an example, but I think it fits very well for what's going on, and I see it increasingly here in Europe as well. So the strike at John Deere, it concluded, I think, after 5 weeks, and we saw an increase in retirement benefits. We saw 10% immediate salary bumps. We saw 5% wage increases for 2023 and 2025, and a quarterly cost of living adjustment that was negotiated alongside a $8,500 bonus. So that's an example of what's really going on, and I think that employees are now finally realizing that inflation is a topic again. And they want higher salaries. We're seeing interesting developments when it comes to housing. I think there's an 18 or 20 month lag between rising rents, which is, I think, 25% of the CPI, and rising inflation. So given the fact that rents are up only a little less than 4% in the last year, while housing prices nationwide are up about, I think, 20 or 22%, we will probably going forward see a lot of rent inflation that will have to find its way into the CPI over the next year. I think we're also seeing that velocity has now stabilized. Our dear friend Russell Napier, he said, forecasting velocity is fiendishly difficult. It's like trying to juggle an incontinent squid, something you really don't want to do, and you're very unlikely to be successful. But we all know that Omicron seems really to be the game changer. So from my point of view, the whole COVID crisis is basically over. Therefore, I would expect that velocity will stabilize, that velocity will actually start picking up. So that should be another inflationary driver. We're seeing that Asian countries are starting to export inflation. We're seeing...
Yeah. Hang on a second, Ronnie. Let's sure. Come back to velocity for a second, because I am confused by what seems to me like a total disconnect between slides 7 and 8 in the deck. When I look at CPI inflation just taking off to 7%, on page 7, I think, okay, everything I've ever studied about inflation is it's very much about the velocity of money, which is a measure of how quickly a unit of currency changes hands from one party to another over a period of time. And I look at this chart and I just say, boy, for inflation to be going like that, velocity of money must be really picking up. And then I look at page 8, it's like, no, it's like a 120-year low? How's that possible?
Well, I think that, you know, we're seeing basically a couple of different things. First of all, I think it's the fact that fiscal policy is now becoming much more important than traditional monetary policy. So I think we should perhaps focus less on what the Federal Reserve is saying and doing, and focus more on what politicians are doing. And you know, I think that big government is back, and that politicians really enjoyed their kind of, you know, moments of glory in the COVID crisis, where everybody was super anxious and wanted politicians to pick up the slack and stop the crisis. So I think, you know, first of all, we should focus more on fiscal policy, which has a much more and much more direct and faster impact on the economy, on economic growth and inflation numbers. The second thing is, we could also ask ourselves, well, if velocity is at that low levels, and it's actually at levels that we saw the last time in 1933 and 1946, and in both cases the US government basically resorted to radical measures. So, you know, if we're seeing velocity at such low points and inflation is still picking up significantly, then we could also ask ourselves the question, well, you know, what's going to happen if velocity really picks up, when market participants start realizing, well, this might be some sort of, you know, as the Austrians would say, a cracker boom, and just want to get rid of their paper money. And I think that might be the next stage. Now, what's going to happen then? And if we look back into the history books, at times when velocity was at similarly low levels, well, in 1934, we all know that the US devalued the dollar against gold by almost 70%. And in 1946, and actually in the time 1946 till 1951, I think, they enforced massive financial repressions. So basically, they kept interest rates at a very low level. They implemented some sort of a yield curve control. And I think both of the things, a devaluation against gold and the yield curve control, is something that we could expect going forward. So long story short, I think that given the fact that inflation is so high, despite the fact that we're seeing strength in the dollar, despite the fact that velocity is so low, is actually some sort of a confirmation that the case for future inflation, for extremely negative real yields over the next couple of years, if not decades, that's probably makes the case even stronger.
Ronnie, one of the things that you'll hear a lot of analysts speculate about, including myself, is maybe what's going on here with gold kind of having a hard time getting moving, is that crypto has stolen the show, as you put it on page 9 of the slide deck. Boy, this slide showing fund flows is really compelling. But, you know, if you look at whether or not crypto is behaving as an inflation hedge or as a risk hedge or what have you, you know, look at the last week or so, where gold is up on a lot of uncertainty and crypto's not doing so well. So it seems like maybe that's not the case. So in your opinion, because this is something a lot of people have disagreed with me, they say, no, it's not about crypto stealing the show from gold. That's not what it is. Is that what it's about? And if it's not, boy, how do you explain these fund flows?
Well, you know, I wouldn't overrate it, Eric. Well, actually, we have two funds where we combine physical gold with cryptos. One of them is just Bitcoin in cold storage, where we basically harvest the enormous volatility by an option strategy, which works tremendously well in markets like at the moment. I think, you know, there's very, very strong opinions in the gold camp and also in the crypto camp. From my point of view, I think there is many, many similarities, but what we saw recently is clearly that Bitcoin, at the moment at least, is a risk-on asset. I think it was a leading indicator on the downside for the S&P. We saw it at end of 2017. We saw it in February 2020. We saw it with Bitcoin basically going down a couple of weeks before the S&P and the NASDAQ crashed. So it is definitely a sign of risk appetite. And it's also a leading indicator on the upside. We saw that at the Christmas 2018. We saw it at the S&P crash low. I think it was March 23, 2020. So Bitcoin clearly at the moment is an indicator for risk appetite of investors. But as we can see on this chart showing the flows, you know, last year, Bitcoin's market cap basically reached 10% of gold's market cap. And now it really cannot be ignored anymore. And I think it was kind of ridiculed from the gold camp and it was kind of neglected. But now it's really becoming, it's kind of growing up. So we're seeing more and more traditional banks are offering services related to crypto assets. We're seeing that regulatory authorities are implementing or drafting regulatory frameworks. We're seeing, you know, tax authorities are kind of detailing the tax treatment of crypto assets and so on. And I think, you know, for crypto enthusiasts who are in this space for many years already, these may be negative developments, but I think for the masses, for the larger institutional players, this is really some sort of a confidence building sign. So I think, you know, I would not overrate the flows that are, as we can see on this chart, going in an opposite direction. But I think that crypto is clearly stealing the, let's say, the media spotlight from gold. So I mean, last year, if I talked, you know, if we put out some research on gold, you know, journalists, they couldn't care less. That's like the most boring thing you can write about. While if you come up with a fancy headline saying, you know, why Bitcoin goes to a million, this is something that every journalist will kind of pick up. And this is changing now. I think the market is realizing that, well, actually, you know, there are major corrections happening in crypto still. But from my point of view, I think I don't think that this bull market is over. And the main reason is, as you can see on the next slide, it's slide 10. It's basically the stock to flow ratio, which is very, very similar for gold and for Bitcoin. Bitcoin will be starting in 2024. It will have a significantly lower inflation rate. So the stock to flow ratio will be at 121. So therefore, I think, you know, I really don't know if Bitcoin will be around in 10 years from now. I would see it rather as a binary thing. But if it will be around in 10 years, boy, I think it's going to be significantly higher than it is today. And from my point of view, coming from the macro side and trying to analyze, you know, monetary growth, future inflation, and so on, from my point of view, the stock to flow ratio of gold and of Bitcoin, this relative scarcity that we are having in our monetary system, this is really crucial to understand. So I'm on record saying that we're still very, very early on. Of course, there will be major setbacks, but I think both gold and Bitcoin are kind of non-sovereign hedges against the monetary debasement, against deeply negative real yields in an environment where central banks basically globally pursue ultra-loose monetary policy and really try to dilute their currencies and win the currency wars. And I think in such an environment, it just makes sense to hold gold, but also probably to a smaller degree because it's the volatility is significantly higher, but also to have some allocation to Bitcoin or even other cryptos.
Now, Ronnie, I'm sure some people are probably thinking, what are you guys even doing talking about gold? The Fed is about to begin a rate hiking cycle. Everybody knows rate hiking cycles are always bad for gold. Dovish is good for gold. Hawkish is bad for gold. But I moved to page 16. The data doesn't say that, does it?
No, the data doesn't say. I think this is becoming even more pronounced.
Because so many people believe that, you know, dovish, good for gold, hawkish, bad for gold. That's just how it works. But it's not.
Exactly. I talked about 2015 and 1999, where the first rate hike basically marked the lows, marked the bottoms in gold. And as you can see on chart 16, actually, of course, the 1980s, where interest rates moved much, much faster, it didn't really work. And it was a tough decade for gold. But based on our research, actually, gold is discounting the future rate hikes. And as soon as the rate hike cycle starts, actually, the worst is over. So it's a little bit of a, you know, sell the rumor, buy the fact. And you know, Eric, you know, you've had so many discussions on this fabulous podcast with great thought leaders in the macro space. I think we don't really have to talk about the debt situation. We don't have to talk about the policy errors that have already been made. So therefore, I think, you know, it's going to be a very short and very shallow rate hike cycle. But what's really going to be interesting, Eric, and this is something that Jim Bianco wrote a tweet storm about. He wrote about the first week of January in the bond markets. And actually, the first week was really epic. We saw the 10-year note finishing its worst week in 42 years with a total return loss of more than 4%. So only the February 1980 saw a bigger loss for a calendar weekly loss. We all know what happened in February 1980 when Paul Volcker actually panicked and the Fed funds rate headed to 25%. For the 30 years, it was, I think, a 9.3% total return loss just in the first week of January. Now, the big question, Eric, is, we all know that you know, risk parity and basically every asset allocator out there says that bonds are the anti-fragile bedrock of every portfolio. Now, what if this time is over? At what point will investors rethink their portfolios? At what point will they realize, well, perhaps bonds aren't the best hedge in this environment anymore? And I think this will really be the point in time when major players will rediscover gold and we will see major inflows into the gold space as some sort, not as a satellite investment, but really as a core investment of every portfolio. And I'm not speaking about 40-50%, but 5-10%. Why not? If market participants realize that, if the portfolio allocation shifts in that direction, and I think that inflation is probably the trigger that will lead to this rethinking of market participants, then I think will be the time when gold really, really picks up momentum. And probably we're not too far away from that point.
Let's move on to page 22, where we have a series of slides talking about the gold mining shares, which, boy, you think gold has not done that well. The mining shares are even worse.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm analyzing and investing in mining space, in the mining space for 15 years now, and that's a tough one. I lost quite a lot of hair and nerves investing in the mining space. However, and I think that also applies for silver. I don't think that mining equities can really decouple from the price of gold. I don't think that silver can decouple from gold. But I think at some point, if we really move higher in the price of gold, I think that the mining stocks will have their big moment. And as you can see on the next slide, well, actually, the GDM index, which is the gold miners index, it's not only relative to its own history, but also relative to the S&P 500. It's extremely cheaply valued. We are seeing, for example, that the dividend yield, I mean, mining stocks over the last cycle never really had big payout ratios and never really had big dividend yields. Now they're at 2.3%, which is significantly higher than the dividend yield for the S&P 500. But it's not only that, it's margins are really high. We're seeing that price earnings, price EBITDA, price sales, and so on are very, very attractive. We have seen that over the last couple of months that most of the companies really got rid of their debt. So we're seeing pristine balance sheets in the mining space. We're seeing that, of course, the major players, they have seen some cost inflation. But for example, for next year, we do expect the all-in sustaining costs at roughly $1,250. So at $1,850 for gold, that's still a pretty nice margin, I would say. And just recently, we saw that M&A activities are picking up. We're seeing more share buybacks. We're seeing lots of nice price action, actually, in the companies that we follow, especially. So I think, and you know, this kind of gives me goosebumps because I would have never expected to say something in my life, but I think we're seeing great value plays in the mining space. And therefore, you know, we feel like little kids in the candy store. We're seeing super attractive valuations given at this price level of gold. But if our assumptions are correct, that we are in the bull market, that gold will make new all-time highs, I'm expecting tremendous performance in the gold mining space and even more so in the silver mining space.
Ronnie, we're starting to run out of time, so I want to move all the way forward to slide 33, your forecast for 2022. Give us the quick rundown of what we can expect.
Well, this is some sort of a tradition that I'm doing every year at the Precious Metals Conference in Munich that didn't take place, unfortunately, due to COVID. But those bold forecasts are something really big over here in the German-speaking world. So I think my most important calls are that gold will make new all-time highs this year. I see oil rising into the triple digits. I'm extremely confident when it comes to nickel. I see uranium spot rising to $60. From my point of view, at some point, a central bank or a sovereign wealth fund will start buying bitcoins. I see Federal Reserve with only one rate hike, Tesla stock correcting 50% from the top, and Elon Musk resigning as CEO. And probably the boldest forecast, I don't think, unfortunately, that Austria will win the Football World Cup.
Well, that one I'm sure we can agree on. Ronnie, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, tell us a little bit more. You run a fund for Incrementum. You also published the In Gold We Trust report, which is one of the most respected fundamental analysis books on gold. And it's free, too. It comes out May of each year, doesn't it?
Yes, we're already working hard on the upcoming In Gold We Trust report. 24th of May is the big date. We will publish it in German and in English, but this year for the first time also in Spanish. And before that, we will publish our In Gold We Trust preview chart book that should come out beginning of March. But most people know us because of our In Gold We Trust report that is really dear to our heart. We love researching the topic of gold, which is not only about gold, it's actually about everything. So we really enjoy this, but primarily we're asset managers based in Liechtenstein, managing 6 funds. We're a boutique player focusing mostly on commodities, precious metals, and cryptos.
And for our accredited and institutional audience who are able to invest in those funds, how do they contact you to find out more about them?
Well, have a look at our webpage, incrementum.li, but you can also contact me on Twitter. My handle is @RonStoefele, and you will also find my contact details on my webpage.
Ronnie, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. I've got a mind-blowing stat for you. The richest 1% own 43% of global wealth, and they're only getting richer. How are they doing it? By building smart, well-diversified portfolios and investing in blue-chip art. With little correlation to equities, Art prices have outpaced the S&P 500 from 1995 through 2021, which means when the market goes down, a well-diversified art portfolio might not. It's no wonder that ultra-wealthy collectors invest 10 to 30% of their overall portfolios in blue-chip art. Now you can, too, with Masterworks. Masterworks is the billion-dollar alternative investing platform that allows you to add paintings from iconic artists like Banksy, Picasso, and Basquiat to your portfolio at an affordable entry point. Masterworks is giving my listeners priority access to their newest offerings. Start building an intelligent portfolio today at masterworks.art/macrovoices. That's masterworks.art/macrovoices. See important disclaimers at masterworks.io/disclaimer.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Ronnie back on the show. Like, he just always has some great insights on gold. It's interesting that gold did make such a big reaction in the post-FOMC period. Certainly will be interesting to see where the dust settles and how this all plays out.
Yeah, you know, I look at this as no surprise at all that we've had this massive move down in gold prices in the last 2 days. It's a knee-jerk reaction to the Fed, very clearly. Question now is, will that be sustained? Is it just the beginning of a huge sell-off as the whole world realizes that a hawkish Fed that really does, you know, reduce its balance sheet, normalize the economy, and go back to pre-2009 normal world economics, that would be very bad for gold. Question in my mind is the market going to react to that narrative and take it seriously for a while, which would mean gold prices going down sharply? Or is the market going to look beyond this and say, why is the Fed doing all of this stuff suddenly? Because inflation is starting to run away and it's going to continue to get worse, and the Fed is eventually going to be forced to reverse path. They're going to have to accommodate in order to not crash the economy and crash markets, and they're going to exacerbate the inflation, and it's going to be good for gold. So as I look at this, what the Fed is telling us is a long-term setup that's very bullish for gold. Will the market look at it that way, or will they look at just what that short-term impact on real interest rates is going to be and say gold has to go down before it can go up? Well, we'll see what happens. But right now, Patrick, I want to get to the big question from the market wrap. Is the market bottom in down at 4,200 or whatever it was on the S&P, looking at about 4,312 on S&P futures as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon? What's the answer? Is the bottom in?
Well, let's look at page two. What is interesting is just using the moving averages of the 50 and the 200-day just as a kind of an idea of where the prevailing uptrend kind of key levels are. We're trading now for the first time since June of 2020 below both moving averages. So it just shows the magnitude of the selling and just how oversold we are on the short term. We haven't had a proper 10%+ market correction in a very long time. And that's exactly it, a correction. And the question in the bigger context is a 10% correction sufficient, or do we need a larger or deeper variety one to really kind of finish washing everything out? Now, what is interesting is that so far, every rally that the market has put together in this week has, after just, you know, 100 quick S&P points to the upside, immediately is met with selling and distribution. So we have not seen some sort of a buy cycle come off yet. So the market remains quite vulnerable at this stage, trading down along those lows. Now, what the bulls do have going for them is on page three, when we look at the volatility index, which is that one of the things we highlighted last week was that we didn't see that spike in volatility yet, which made the market still vulnerable, that there wasn't yet that kind of capitulation selling, that fear built up in the market that would typically be associated with some sort of a tradable low. Well, this week we got it. I mean, we printed almost as high as 40 on the VIX. That kind of scare drop did happen. And this is where we're going to get some incredibly valuable information. Typically, once volatility spikes this high, on balance of probabilities, more often than not, the reversion of the volatility back down to the low 20s has a Vanna tailwind to them, equity markets, which slingshots them higher, and a bottom usually is established. And what will be really interesting to see is what happens here at this moment. Because in the past, when we had the really ugly events, such as, let's say, March 2020, volatility just would not go back down, and it would just keep slingshotting higher. The bottom line is that we're at a really important critical moment. If we see that the bulls can dig in and hold the FOMC lows, like the lows that came in from that selling, and we turn things back up, a rally back to 4,600 would be very natural. But if every rally is failing and we continue to see intraday selling just keep hammering the market, once that we're down at 4,300 or below 4,300, the vulnerability is that we are going to still have one more quick drop on the downside. The analog I like to think of in the back of my mind is what happened during the 2018 Christmas massacre. While the whole market correction played out over multiple months, there were two very violent rallies in between that were 300 plus S&P points to the upside. And I think the key thought that I have there is that even if we did have a very fast and rapid snap in the market to the upside, can we trust it? And it's a great time to just be watching these markets on an intraday basis and reading the tea leaves, because there's so much opportunity out there, and just trying to figure out where the selling has finally subsided is going to be critical.
Moving on to page four, we've got the Euro-US dollar cross. Boy, there's a big nosedive there after the Fed meeting. What's going on with this chart?
Right. And I mean, we always look at the dollar index, but the big traded weighted currency in there is that euro. And the euro had a couple weeks ago a quick pop up towards 115 on the upside. And we were just at the time trying to determine whether that was actually a meaningful breakout or was it a fake out. And it stopped right in the Fibonacci retracement zones and has now decisively turned. But with the fact that we have now broken those November-December consolidation lows, there is the vulnerability of the euro to trade back down to 2020 lows is on the table. And I mean, at this stage, with this breakdown, we could see 110, even 108 on the downside during one of these sell sequences. At some point, the dollar will likely peak out. But the question in my mind is it one of those things that's going to be more timed around the March rate hike? Maybe what it is that we'll spend much of February with dollar strength and euro weakness as the dominant trends, and it will take something like that first rate hike in March to potentially put in a short-term dollar top. And that's it's going to be really interesting to see how this continues to trade out. With that said, Eric, let's move on to page five. And I wanted to just touch on the crude oil, but also that time spread chart that you wanted to talk about. So right now, you can clearly see on the continuous contract, oil did break to that higher high. I mean, after even a little 3-4 day pullback with the break, the way it's doing, it's like it seems like $90 is just in reach, and that we realistically can see it here. What's your take on this chart, and how should we look at those term chart futures spreads?
Well, Patrick, first of all, I do think that we've got further to go to the upside. I am still bullish on crude oil here, but I'm going to throw in the caveat that the easy work is done. You know, it's $62. It was very easy to say this is an Omicron panic that is misplaced and we're about to see a reversal. We did say that here on Macro Voices. What happened next is we saw the very predictable, not just 100% reversal, but more than 100% retracement of that Omicron panic move down. Okay, well, now we're back up to cycle highs. We're, you know, above $85 here. We're at the point where crude oil really becomes a serious political issue, and there are significant political headwinds to higher prices. And of course, you know, the Biden administration wants you to think that they've been working all along on keeping gas prices down. Well, now it's at the point where shit gets real. We're not just talking about people are a little bit annoyed with the gasoline prices. They're really getting pissed off. And the thing is, it doesn't matter how pissed off they get. I don't think anything is going to stop all of the fundamental factors that are pushing crude oil prices higher. But I do want to emphasize that I think right now, when you see these really elevated prices in the high 80s and you think, oh, okay, maybe that just means that there's really a long-term expected increase in demand. Actually, that's not what the market's telling us. And let's move on to page 6, where we look at the time spreads, which is the measure of the difference in price from one contract to the next. So you see the yellow line there that's labeled H2-J2. That says the price of the March futures contract, the one for delivery in March of 22, is priced $1.35 higher than the April of 22 contract. That's J2. And then the next one, April to May, is the next one down. The purple one at $1.19. May to June is $1.11. June to July is $1.03, and so forth. Well, it's unusual for these spreads to be bigger than about 50 cents of backwardation on a one-month basis. What's going on? The reason for that big premium on the earlier delivery contract is there's a growing fear of a shortage of physical oil to settle the WTI futures contract. And it used to be that we went really by the physical inventory that was in Cushing, Oklahoma. These days, a lot of these contracts get settled through exchange for physical settlement mechanisms where the oil could be someplace else, but it still has to be deliverable against that WTI contract. So one way or another, the physical oil market is getting really tight. And you're seeing that with the blow up of time spreads. And this is a repeat of something that happened in October and November when there were really significant fears of Cushing, Oklahoma getting down to its minimum operating limits. So that situation continues to develop. Of course, you never know when it's going to reverse, but I think that's driving a lot of the upside pressure on the flat price of oil. Let's move on to gold futures on page 7. You see those two really, really big down candles at the very right end side of the chart. But, you know, just visually looking at it, it really doesn't take us that far out of an established uptrend. In fact, it looks in many ways visually like this is your buy the dip moment if you don't think this thing's going to break down. So what should we think?
You know what? It comes back down to even the way that we approached the euro and the dollar kind of outlook. What is clear is that maybe gold bulls are just looking for the move a little too premature in the cycle. While I'm not bearish gold, it is increasingly likely that we're going to go back into the purgatory trade range for a little bit of a short period of time until a lot of these intermarkets finish these cycle moves. I mean, we've seen in the past as well that during periods where the stock market is risk off, that doesn't tend to have gold rallying until after the selling cycle has finished. So right now, with this reversal, this does take the wind out of the sails of the gold bulls, and it does likely increase the probability that this thing is going to be far more range bound in these. And I think that it's going to take maybe a good chunk of the first quarter to really establish that base that will kind of drive gold higher, the way Ronnie kind of describes some of the catalysts behind it. So right now, one of the things I'm just going to be watching is whether or not the bottom end of these trade ranges now hold, which is like the 1775 areas where a lot of the consolidations lows have happened in the past. But what I wanted to do, Eric, is move on here to page 8, where we look at the 10-year treasury note futures. Rather than, we normally look at rates, but I wanted to look at the actual bonds themselves, which move inversely. And really what I thought was just worthy, because Ronnie talked about it as well in that interview with you, is just that many people in the traditional 60-40 portfolio or the risk parity funds have always anchored off of the 10-year notes as the kind of anti-risk-off asset that will basically do well when other things are doing poorly and reduce the overall volatility of portfolios. And it's actually amazing to me how the markets have really started to wobble and turn, and that defensiveness that the 10-year note has shown in the past just has not emerged at all. And that certainly is heightening portfolio volatility overall. And I wonder whether or not this is actually going to contribute to even more volatility moving forward in portfolios.
Patrick, the next four charts, starting on page 9, we're looking at the global equity indices, stock markets from Japan, China, Australia, and South Korea. Why these particular charts, and what are they telling us?
I cherry picked just some of many of the global markets out there. But I think that the one thing I really wanted to capture to wrap up the chart deck was we keep looking at this as the Fed and the U.S. equity markets. But what it's important to just stop and reflect upon is that there is the rest of the global marketplace, which in general, central banks are tightening. They're in line with what the Fed is doing. And a lot of global stock markets are demonstrating similar style weakness. And so this is not just about the FANG stocks driving the selling in the U.S. equity markets, but we are seeing substantial price deterioration in many global indices as developed markets. I maybe should have included the Euro stock weakness in this chart mix as well, but like the Nikkei is breaking below a one-year trade range on the downside, very similar to what we saw in the Russell 2000. China continues to be trading at the bottom end of one-year ranges, well off of its major highs. Again, Australia was in a substantial sideways trade range for 6-7 months and broken that to the downside. And then a lot of these kind of Asian markets like the South Korean index are in outright sell mode. And in fact, the selling is almost accelerating in those markets to the downside. And I think that it's very important to when kind of sizing up what's happening in the U.S. equity markets, recognizing that the global equity complex is very weak. And there seems to be a lot of bear market style price action happening everywhere in the world. And I wonder whether or not it's really as simple as analyzing the Fed and the U.S. markets when the entire system is under so much pressure.
Listeners, Patrick emphasized earlier the importance in this environment of keeping an eye on these markets on an intraday basis. Well, if you want to get Patrick's chart decks and webinars not only once a week, but every single day of the week, be sure to check out page 13 where you can get information about a free trial of Big Picture Trading, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's episode. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks, the billion-dollar alternative investment platform that lets you invest in art by legends like Warhol and Picasso for a fraction of the cost. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Ronnie's slide deck and the chart book we just discussed here in the post game. There's also a variant perception article on revisiting the anatomy of a bubble, as well as a Bill Blaine article on don't worry about timing by the dip. It's more fundamental than that. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That's Eric spelt with a K, and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.